This is the GP Soccer Podcast with your host, Giovanni Piccini. Everyone, Giovanni Piccini here, your host of the GP Soccer Podcast, here for yet another episode. I'm just having a boatload of fun. I keep using that phrase, a boatload of fun. I don't know where that phrase came from, a boatload of fun, but it's an awful big boat for me. That's how much fun I'm having, doing this broadcast, doing this show for all of you out there in my vast, vast listening audience. As I always say, north, south, east, west, everyone in the middle. And my international audience as well. Welcome to the GP Soccer Podcast. You know, the other day, someone came up to me, someone I know, they listened to the show. They're a soccer fan with a small F. And they said, you know, I listen to both your shows because, as you know, not only do I do the GP Soccer Podcast here in podcast land, I also host a brand new show in the Boston area, WMEX AM 1510, called Direct Kick. So you can get a double dose of yours truly on both my shows. But he said, you know, I always get the impression that you're talking to me. You're having this conversation with me. And I guess as a broadcaster, I guess that's high praise. I'm taking it as high praise. For indeed, I am talking to you. And when I say you, you can be in this profession, if you will. You as a thousands of people. But more specifically, I am talking to you, the individual. I'm talking to you, that person who just flipped on your computer and you put on GP Soccer Podcast or Direct Kick or whatever, and you're listening to me. I'm having a conversation with you. You're streaming it somewhere, and you're in your technological world, if you will. And yeah, I'm having a conversation with you. And on my Direct Kick show on WMX in Boston, you could flip on your radio and you're sitting there maybe in traffic. And yeah, I'm having a conversation with you as you make your commute home. But I am having a conversation with each and every one of you, that being members of my listening audience from literally around the world. So I really appreciated the observation, the comment by my friend, and felt like I was talking to you, and that means a great deal to me. Where I do have that capacity to connect with people, and so far so good. The GP Soccer Podcast, as you very well know by now, we're into our eighth season. This is indeed season eight, and we're just kicked off the new Direct Kick show on WMX. So that's a whole new audience in and around the Boston area, Eastern Massachusetts, where again I have opportunities to talk to you, soccer fans, soccer people. You may not even be a soccer fan. You just like to tune in and maybe learn about the game. I don't know. But I certainly appreciate the comments, and I will continue to do just that, ladies and gentlemen. Talk to you, my listening audience. Yep, and doing so with a boatload of fun. Great interview guest today, someone who I've known for a great many years, Jared Scarpacci, who's the boys soccer coach at Masconomet Regional High School up in Topsfield, Massachusetts. Jared and I go back many years where during the days we were both head coaches collegiately, and we were competing against each other in the same conference. So we saw each other with great regularity year in and year out. And as you'll note and you'll hear and you'll certainly sense in the interview block, the conversation I had with Jared, that he was one of those guys that I really enjoyed coaching against. You could always rely on the fact that when you stepped on the field, competing against a team that Jared was overseeing, his teams were going to be well prepared. They were going to play a good brand of soccer. They were going to be competitive. It would make for a really nice afternoon or evening of collegiate soccer, knowing that my adversary, and I kind of put that in quotes, my adversary across the way, could do such a nice job. And on top of all of that, we became good friends. We could chat before the match. We could chat after the match. And it was just one of those kind of wonderful relationships. You're going to enjoy the conversation I'm going to have after the commercial break up with Jared Scarpacci, the boys' coach up at Mascanomic High School in Topsfield, Massachusetts. So, you know, in scouring the internet, you can hear the paper there. I still download stuff. I put it on a piece of paper. That's just how I roll. What can I tell you? But in you know, researching the internet, looking for content, looking for stuff that kind of catches my eye, my ear, you know, I get stuff, I download it, I put it on a piece of paper, and I share with you, my listening audience. And this one, my goodness, this one really caught my eye. It's an article written by Eric Winalda. And we all know who Eric Winalda is, you know, former U.S. men's national team player, and played in Major League Soccer, and one of our, arguably one of our better players here in the United States of America. And you know, very outspoken, certainly very outspoken when it comes to the state of the game here in the United States of America. I've gone to listen to him speak on numerous occasions, and more often than not, I'm nodding my head in the affirmative for a lot of the things that he talks about. Certainly the areas of the game that still need improvement, even in this day and age in 2023, even after coming off the 2022 World Cup, where our men's national team, you know, made it to the round of 16, there are still issues, more on the men's side than on the women's side. And he kind of tackles some of these things. And the article's not very long. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but there's some things that jumped out at me that I want to kind of add my own two cents, you know, with Eric talks about in this particular article. And the article is entitled, "From Coaches to Pushy Parents, U.S. Men's Soccer is Married to Mediocrity." I agree with that. I'm going to start my commentary right off, absolutely positively. I'll give you some context. Now, I've been doing this for a long time. When I say this, I've coached the game. I'm a clinician. I'm a coach developer. I'm a coach educator. I'm a goalkeeper coach. I've worked at the grassroots level. I've gone through high school, club, ODP, state teams, the collegiate level. In some of my work in coach development, coach education, I've dealt with professional level coaches and players. You know, from top to bottom, I've been involved. I've been a player, you know, from youth to high school to college. And if you blink your eye, I played a minute and a half of professional soccer. And I say it all the time. I'll continue to say it. And this is kind of where I kind of go hand in hand with Eric Winalda here. Here we are in 2023, and we still here in the United States of America with all the resources, all the things we have available to us to develop high-level players, we still can't do it. We still can't do it. And there's a lot of reasons why, and Eric goes into it in his article, and some of which I will comment on. But he goes on to say, "The American soccer community is still reeling from the fallout between former U.S. men's national team coach Greg Berhalter and the Reyna family. It left the men's soccer program in an absolute shambles, without a head coach, sporting director, or general manager. The whole thing is a mess, and yet we see similar things in soccer across the U.S. every day. It's a product of the industry we've created. Parents feel entitled because they hand over big money for their child to play. They effectively pay to have an opinion." So the industry he talks about there is the corporatization of youth sports. And that's a mega billion-dollar industry in this country that grows year after year after year. There's a lot of money to be made in youth sports. There's a lot of money to be made in soccer in this country. And when you add a bottom line, when you add the almighty dollar to a youth sports entity, heck, never mind youth sports, in any entity, you run the risk of compromise. You run the risk of, you know, malpractice. You run the risk of lowering standards because of the almighty dollar. And in this case here, as Eric talks about, parents shelling out a whole lot of money for the kids to play club soccer or youth soccer. They feel like they're entitled to have an opinion. Well, ladies and gentlemen, you don't. You pay for your kid for the right to play. You don't pay for the right to shoot your mouth off. So he goes on to say, why is U.S. soccer still a laughingstock? Well, there's a $1 million question, huh? He goes on to say, people don't want to hear the reasons why, because they're totally counterproductive to the industry, there's that word, we've created. But here's the first one. There are too many kids playing soccer. Got to admit, folks, that one jumped out at me. But as I read on, I got it. He goes on to say, let me rephrase that. It's wonderful that kids are playing the beautiful game, no doubt. But there are too many parents paying thousands of dollars for their kids to play alongside truly great players. That's not helping our best ones, and it doesn't help the average ones who are outclassed in every game they play. Our best players need to be playing with and against each other, not alongside a bunch of kids who effectively act as training cones. Spot on. Because let me tell you something here. Here's what contributes to that. you pay X amount of $1,000 for a club, right? They're in a business. And what happens is, and I'm not saying every club does this, so spare me the emails, But, you know, they're in it to make a buck. And what they'll do is they'll have, oh, geez, we've got X amount of teams. Boy, we don't have enough kids to, you know, to fill out this roster at this age group or that roster at that age group. So they bring on kids, they take the money so they can fill out a roster. So what happens is you've got rosters oftentimes that, let's say 20, I'm going to be very arbitrary. And, you know, of the 20, maybe 5, 6, 7 are good high-level players, but then the rest are, you know, less than that, or they're average. They're average. But each one of those roster spots filled with a player means dollars. Means dollars. Means dollars. So what happens? The team is watered down. Training sessions are watered down. The competitive nature of games is watered down because those roster spots mean dollars. Mr. Winalda goes on to say, the boutique club programs they're meant to play in aren't helping either. A while back, the U.S. Soccer Federation de-emphasized high school soccer in order to prioritize club soccer. That was a mistake. Our best young players now have no idea what pressure is. They play their biggest games in front of a few parents in lawn chairs rather than in buzzing high school stadiums with pride and a sense of occasion on the line, as are your opponent's fans who are yelling at you for 90 minutes. You can't replace, you know, high school soccer, high school sports. You really can't. That whole approach was an absolute disaster. I get why they did it. In terms of, you know, creating that the DA and designating clubs as development academy, you know, programs and clubs, but it was an abject failure. Again, like many that has occurred with U.S. soccer. He goes on to say, now the national team used to operate by creating districts with trials. Out of that, they'd create a few state teams, the Olympic Development Program, commonly known as ODP. These days, our youth soccer arrangement is still ODP, but now it's Overdetermined Parent Program. These parents' goal is to get their child a college scholarship and essentially a return on the tens of thousands of dollars they've invested in youth sports. Again, it goes back to my point earlier. Parents feel like compelled that I paid X amount of dollars and it gives me the right to shoot my mouth off or to tell the coach where to play my Johnny or Janie or how you should play against a certain opponent. No, once again, I'll beat the dead horse. You have paid for the right for your children to participate. And I'll take it a step further. You have paid for the right. What you're not paying for is to say, you know, I'm paying for my kid to start. No, you're not doing that either. Let's move on. Mr. Winalda talks further. America's elite youth soccer system has been problematic for a while. When U.S. Soccer disbanded its development academy in 2020, one of the main criticisms about the setup came from referees. They complained that club games weren't competitive enough. These manufactured games inevitably featured coaches telling players not to make any mistakes and to focus solely on possession. They might as well have folded up the goals and taken them home because nobody was taking any shots and no one was taking any risks or taking on an opponent. Everyone treated soccer like a giant game of hot potato. I couldn't agree more. You look at the last World Cup, and actually the next paragraph, he talks about this, but I'll paraphrase. You look at the last World Cup for the U.S. men's national team. What was the single biggest thing that came out of, you know, people's mouths? Whether you're a fan or you're a pundit, you're a reporter. Boy, we don't have a number nine. Boy, we don't have a goal scorer. No, we don't. We don't have a goal scorer. Not even close. And that is a direct result of our youth soccer, our club soccer, high school, college. Everyone who's involved, the developmental aspect of the game is responsible for this shortcoming. We have to get our kids to want to take risks and to take on defenders to go to goal and encourage them to shoot. And when they miss, you'll get the next one. We want our young players to be bold and have courage and want to score goals and want to take shots. But we don't. And you know what, parents and fans, you're responsible for this too in terms of, you know, our kids not wanting to take shots, can't take shots, afraid to take shots. Because every time little Johnny or Janie takes a shot, what do you hear from the crowd? You know what? I guess if I was a kid, I wouldn't want to take a shot either. So you got to change your behavior in the stands, ladies and gentlemen. Then when Johnny or Jenny takes a shot and they miss, you cheer them on. He or she should hear. You'll get the next one. You'll get the nice try. Good shot. You know, excellent effort, whatever. So we have to change the developmental dynamic in this country regarding developing number nine players. We have to change the mindset of coaches. We have to change the mindset of parents so that indeed this country, this massive country, this massive soccer country can produce a whole bunch of number nines. Because right now, ladies and gentlemen, there is not, at least on the men's side, there's not a player who strikes fear in the hearts of defenders from teams from other countries. That I can assure you. Let's move on. The last couple of paragraphs here from Eric Winalda's article here. Now let's look at how coaches are made. Oh boy, this one struck home with me. Here's a good story. A couple of years ago, I gave a speech on player development at the annual United Soccer Coaches Convention, which, by the way, I did attend this particular presentation. He goes on to say, afterward, I had a beer with a professional scout from Holland who'd heard my talk about American players. He goes on to say, this scout from the Netherlands, we're very much enjoying seeing the United States shoot itself in the foot every year, he said. I asked him what he meant. He smiled, paused, and then said, out of curiosity, why are only 10 coaches in a country of 350 million people allowed to get their U.S. soccer pro-level coaching license every year? He's spot on. If I were trying to ensure stagnation in America, I'd populate the federation with ideas that prohibit us from growing the number of coaches. Why are we implementing European-style programs suited for countries of 10 million people in a country of our size? In other words, America has a lot of players, but if you limit the number of coaches, what can they do? Spot on. Spot on. Again, this lands at the doorstep of U.S. soccer, our federation. And their you know, backwards mindset, ignorant mindset, that we're somehow like Belgium or Germany or Italy or England and any number of soccer-sophisticated nations. We are not. We are the United States of America. We are a different sporting landscape. And by association, we're a different soccer landscape. We're unique. We're unique compared to all those other soccer nations from around the world. Subsequently, we have to act uniquely. We have to act in methods and ways that are unique to the United States of America, not Germany or Belgium or Holland or wherever. And that falls in the laps of U.S. soccer. We're not those countries. Now, I could go on a rant, and I will continue to rant about some of these things. Well, I'm a coach developer. I'm a coach educator. It boggles my mind, and I've had conversations with folks at the highest levels regarding this issue. It boggles my mind that U.S. soccer basically says, you know what, in terms of licensure and certification, it's our way or the highway. Now, we have United Soccer Coaches, of which I am a proud staff member, that puts forth, arguably, in many areas, better content than U.S. soccer. We certainly have a wider variety of topics that people can pursue. Why can't, you know, folks sit down in a room and figure out a way to get United Soccer Coaches under the umbrella of U.S. soccer, right? So we can broaden the opportunities for people to get coaching certifications, coaching licenses. Now, I'm not naive. I know how this works. This is a global thing because U.S. soccer is a member of FIFA, and FIFA oversees all of soccer around the world. Okay, and you just can't sit down in a room in a weekend and hammer this stuff out. There's a lot that goes behind something like that. But it's not impossible. And I got to believe, and I'm naive, and we know how FIFA operates, that sometimes, you know, they're not the best and the brightest either sometimes. They would embrace the opportunity to bring in formally a coaching organization that does great work in terms of developing American soccer coaches and increasing the landscape, expanding the landscape for coaches all across this country to get licensed, to get certified, to get qualified, to teach the game of soccer. One of the reasons why we're in the midst of a quagmire of mediocrity in terms of our very many youth soccer players, our high school players, club players, is that we don't have enough coaches who are certified and qualified. So the training environments are, you know, less than adequate, you know, in terms of developing players. If I see one more activity where there are lines and, you know, this stagnating dynamic that I see all too often. You know, I'll rip what little hair I have left. And I'll take it a step further. When you have so many coaches who are not certified and qualified, they don't make the effort, right? Their training environments are not fun, not challenging. Kids quit. That's a fact. Kids quit. Research is out there. But when coaches get certified, qualified, and embrace coach development, embrace coach education, they do a better job. Training environments are better. It's much more fun. It's challenging. Kids stay. Why wouldn't they? Why wouldn't they stay? Why wouldn't they stay? Let's move on here. Let's wrap this up with Mr. Winalda. This has been going on for years, and we never learn because we're always looking to Europe for ideas, and we keep getting the same results. Every American youth player of a certain age remembers the first time they heard an English accent. Those accents over the years have changed from German to French to Dutch to Portuguese. We end up trusting experts who aren't good enough to succeed in their own countries. Though if I were a mediocre foreign coach who couldn't get the job back home, I'd come to America. Why? Because there's no pressure here. We're married to mediocrity. Now, that last one, that's a touchy one. You know, I've heard the phrase expert by accent. Expert by accent. Now, don't send me emails. I'm not saying every single person who comes from another country to the United States falls into that category. They have an accent and somehow they're expert. A lot of wonderful folks out there that do just that, come here to the United States and do a good job. But there are far, 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 far too many that do come to the United States, and they know full well that with their accent, there is the perceived perception that they have some level of expertise. And that's not the case. Believe me, I've seen more than my fair share of folks who come from different countries, and they get out there, and it's sometimes a mess. It's a mess. And if we were to expand, going back to my earlier point and one that Eric makes in his article, if we did a better job certifying and licensing more coaches across our country, we wouldn't have to rely upon a foreign influence. You'd have your homegrown American coaching talent right here in the good old U.S. of A. And I'll end with a little controversy. I am a proponent of mandating licensure, mandating certification for anyone, and I mean anyone, who has taken on the responsibility to teach the game of soccer to our players in this country. Mandating. Now, this is a whole show, and you know, I'll probably do a whole show on this. I know what happens. Oh, if you mandate, you know, people won't coach and kids won't play. Fine. We reduce the quantity, we increase the quality, you know, maybe the game does get better. I'm going to leave it at that. I'll end with my own bit of controversy. But trust me, ladies and gentlemen out there in the GP Soccer podcast land, it's something that I will continue to talk about. So there you go. That's a little bit of a lengthy opening there. But my goodness, this article from Eric Winalda, it really, as you can tell, struck a chord with me. I agree with a great deal of what he's talking about here. 2023, we've made great progress, certainly in my lifetime. But my goodness, we should be much further ahead than we are today. So we're going to take a commercial break. I'm going to catch my breath because I've been jumping up and down here pontificating. And on the other side, my good friend, Jared Scarpacci, boys soccer coach at Masconomet Regional High School. Giovanni Puccini, GP Soccer Podcast. Don't you dare go anywhere. Hey there, everyone. Giovanni Puccini here, host of the GP Soccer Podcast, excited to bring you some great information about a terrific coach education opportunity. The 2023 National Soccer Coaches Association of Canada National Convention, where the theme is Bringing Soccer Coaches Together Worldwide, will be held April 21st to the 23rd at the Churchill Meadows Community Center in Ontario, Canada. This is shaping up to be a terrific weekend of soccer featuring keynote speakers João Tralajo, former head coach in the Portuguese Primeira League, as well as Boris Kubla, head of coach education for the Croatian Football Federation. Other clinicians include some of the outstanding staff from the NSCAC, like John De Benedictus and Richard Bucciarelli. Be sure to register on the National Soccer Coaches Association of Canada website, nscac.ca, where if you include the discount code of GP50OFF, you'll receive 50% off the registration fee. So don't miss out on this wonderful coaching education opportunity sponsored by the National Soccer Coaches Association of Canada on April 21st to the 23rd at the Churchill Meadows Community Center in Ontario, Canada. Again, be sure to take advantage of the special GP Soccer Podcast discount by typing in GP50OFF in the discount code. Cancer. We all know someone whose life has been impacted by this deadly disease. A friend, a colleague, a family member, someone in your community. No one is immune from it. But as each day passes, the fight continues to find a cure that one day will eradicate cancer from all our lives. One of the ways you can join the fight is through Red Card Cancer. Its mission is a call to action to help defeat the world's biggest opponent by uniting the global game of soccer in the fight against cancer. Together with the American Cancer Society, the soccer community is raising money and awareness for cancer research. If you or your soccer organization would like to support the American Cancer Society and Red Card Cancer, head over to redcardcanceracs.org as well as redcardcancer.org. Red Card Cancer, where a cure is our goal. Welcome back to the GP Soccer Podcast. Your host here, Giovanni Piccini, your very able host, your excited host, because here we are, folks. Again, season 8 of the GP Soccer Podcast, and we're several episodes into the into season 8. It just continues to be a boatload of fun for me. And not only a boatload of fun, as I've kind of hinted before and hinted in the opening block, it's great to be able to connect with people. People that I'm meeting for the first time and people like today's guest who I have known for years. So that's kind of one of those little side benefits of doing the show. It's a lot of fun and the opportunity to connect with new friends, and old friends like our guest today. It's been, again, just a lot of fun. And I know all of you out there, in GP Soccer Podcast land have been enjoying the show. So I teased you about our guest in the opening block, just teased you right there. Our guest today, I'll start by saying the following before I get into his resume. You know, there's some, and I mean this in all sincerity, and he's going to hear this, and he is hearing this. I coached for many, many, many years at the college level. And I guess like any coach in any sport at any level, you know, there's some coaches you just have a lot of respect for. And if you're going to lose a game, and none of us like to lose, but you do. If you're going to lose to a game, sometimes you don't mind losing to a particular coach because you have such immense respect for that person, the way they coach, the way they carry themselves, the way their team plays, the general camaraderie you have with that individual. Jared Scarpacci is one of those people, and I can count those people on one hand and probably not use all of my fingers. We did compete against each other a number of years ago when I was a head coach and he was a head coach, and I lost to him and he lost to me. He was one of those guys where at the end of it all, I just didn't mind. I have that level of respect for Jared Scarpacci. So Jared is currently the head boys soccer coach at Masconomet Regional High School in Topsfield, Massachusetts, former head men's soccer coach at Emerson College, former assistant at Salem State College, assistant at Stetson University, former assistant at Endicott College, and assistant women's soccer coach at Wentworth Institute of Technology. Jared is also the vice president of the Eastern Massachusetts High School Soccer Association. He is the vice president of the Aztec Soccer Club out of Beverly, Massachusetts. Up until 2022, last year, Jared was the board member for Massachusetts Youth Soccer, and he is currently the co-director and founder of Ironsides Soccer Consulting. Jared Scarpacci, my longtime friend, welcome to the GP Soccer Podcast.
Thank you very much. What an introduction. Wow. I mean, one, I think you dug out some things that I had forgotten about there. And thank you for those kind words. It was always great battling against your LaSalle teams quite a bit there back in the GNAC days, for sure, for sure. It was great. And the respect is reciprocated. I always enjoy our conversations, even the, I would call them the pregame chatter. You know, when the coaches met at half field, it was always great. I always look forward to it.
Same here. Those were great moments, mm-hmm. not just between you and I, but if any coaches, and I guess at any sport, at any level, whenever you have the opportunity to connect with an opposing coach and have those great pregame conversations, and sometimes you may find yourself having, albeit not very long, but a brief chat or, during the course of the game and certainly after the game, well, you found someone special. You found someone special. And I like you and looked forward to our matches, and I certainly look forward to our conversation. So, So Jared, my friend, here's where I like to start. My audience knows this. Let's go back to when you were a kid. you were growing up. What were the sports you played? Where did you grow up? What were some of the, you know, did you have any coaches who inspired you? Bring us all the way up from a youth all the way up to the point where you're become a, let's just say a working professional in the sport of soccer.
Yeah. I'm a local kid. I grew up on the North Shore. I grew up in Danvers, a product of Danvers youth soccer, for sure. Played back in the day before there was club. All right. My senior year, 1992, I think it was Nickel, it was called here in Massachusetts. It was the first club league. And there was a club team forming out of Beverly. And a bunch of buddies were on it. And they were like, hey, come be on this. It was, you know, different time. And I remember telling my dad that they played games all around the state. All right. He kind of he's just listening, not saying anything. And I said, yeah, I want to play on this. And he says, well, where's the first game? And I don't know. Let's just say it was on the South Shore. I don't know. And he just looked up and he goes, well, you better start walking now then, if you're going to be in time for the game. All right. He just, you know, I had other siblings at the time. I still do, not at the time. And, you know, and it was just a different era. So you just played locally and pick up and all of that. And I played at Danvers High. That's where I went to high school. I was actually, you know, I was kind of a pickup, you know, pickup basketball, kind of the latchkey kid that was just down at the park playing all those. But obviously, I loved soccer the most growing up in a Portuguese and Italian household there. But I also became track and field was I actually became pretty good at track and field. Ran a year in college. I was a high hurdler, pentathlete. High jumper, triple jumper back in the day, did some things around the state, which were half decent, I guess, as they say. It's all based on time and distance, so it was easy. Did that, went off to college, played, walked on at Siena College for 2 years out there in the MAC, walked on there. And then I transferred to Clemson University, played in the spring down there for a little bit, spring ball, and then just kind of had to graduate. Kind of had to graduate, but they had a pretty vibrant club university team that was made up of all ex-college players. When you go to these big universities that have club teams that don't have some don't have soccer teams, some do. You know, we have so many little schools like your Emersons and LaSalle's where kids will find nooks and crannies. But you know, there's no Division III soccer. I think I want to be clear on this in South Carolina. So, you know, our team was full of like all state kids and whatnot. So they couldn't play at Clemson, you know, win a national championship, but man, they could play. So our club team is actually really very good. We had a coach, we had the whole nine, went to nationals. It was pretty organized. And I just always wanted to have soccer in my life. I think that was something that I really enjoyed. I'm a high school teacher, high school history teacher now. And school was not always easy for me as a student, but I always felt really confident and comfortable on the soccer field. And I liked that feeling, like most people do. So I just wanted to always give back and kind of be, just have the game in my life. You know, my wife says that I am married to soccer and she is the mistress. I'm not sure. I'm not sure I'd go with that, but I understand that it's, you know, I guess it came with the package, and that's sure. And she knew that too. She knew that too, that it's always been a kind of a part of my life. And you meet great people. You know, that's what I love about the global game. You just meet great cultures, great people. It's really been fun. I enjoy it. I've enjoyed every piece of it, from the college game to the high school game, to the club game, to the recreational game. I love it. I love it. And I just love being a part of any type of soccer, any type of soccer.
I don't think you're alone, Jared, in the respect of having a spouse that understands that, you know, they are indeed the mistress and the game is the wife. Yeah. Anyone that does what we do, that's certainly the case. Yeah. Now, staying in that era of your life growing up, what was your original career intent? You know, you're a kid growing up, you're playing soccer, you're enjoying it. You know, was teaching the career intent? Did you have other aspirations? Was there an aha moment when it came to, you know, getting into the coaching realm? Share with my audience that part of your story.
Yeah. The interesting part is I think I always wanted to be a carpenter. All right. I did. I wanted to like build houses. My dad was involved in sort of a handyman and laborer, if you will. And he was pretty adamant saying, you know, if you want to do that, you just got to go to college. And, you know, you want to do that after, that's fine. So I sort of cut that deal with him. I'm not sure where that happened. But when I went to school, my high school soccer coach, Phil Sullivan, great guy. He was also my indoor track coach and my spring track coach. I had him for 12 seasons, if you can imagine this, which is pretty unheard of these days to have that. He's the high school guidance counselor. He was just a great guy, really influential in far as just being a good person, and was always, you know, looking back, I say he was good to all of the players. Meaning he was the same with the star and the same with the kid who wasn't the star on the team. And I just felt that was great. And when I went to college, I knew I couldn't do math. That was pretty evident. So anything with numbers was out. So so that was it. Always loved history. And I thought, you know what, maybe being a history teacher and maybe kind of being, as I had mentioned, you know, the type of teacher that I would have liked to have maybe had. You know, I mentioned I struggled a little bit in school, and that sort of kind of pushed me into education. And then it kind of said, you know, who are those mentors or those people you meet along the road? And Phil Sullivan was one of them. And coaching was really, I wouldn't say I went to college to coach. I certainly went to college to teach and degree in education and history, there, but, it really became a passion of mine. When I started to, I'll never forget, when I started to work soccer camps. I didn't work soccer camps in high school. I worked them in college in the summer. Some summers, not every summer. And first I was in a state of shock that someone was going to pay me to do this. All right. Like, so at the end of the day, I'm going to be at a camp, teach little kids soccer, and then you're going to hand me a check. I felt that was... I mean, to me, that I was a professional. I was a professional soccer player at the time. So that was kind of a little bit of an aha moment, being like, wow, they pay these coaches. Not necessarily well all the time, but they pay these coaches. And I never thought of making a living out of coaching. I just, for some reason, I've had opportunities to do that throughout my career. But, you know, the truth is, I love teaching. I've always loved teaching, and I've been teaching for 20 plus years. I don't know, 22, 23, and I got a good job. I'm one of those people who loves what they do. And if I can tuck soccer in, which I've been able to do, that's an incredible life. So that's sort of where I kind of got there. But, you know, I've met obviously a lot of people along the way who've kind of helped guide this path, including yourself. Mike Kirschger, in my early days when he was the head coach at Endicott College, gave me the chance to be a college coach because I think I wanted to be a college coach, a full-time college coach. I did in those early days while I was teaching and, you know, doing this. I said, yeah, I think I could be a full-time college coach. But back then, you know, you go back 20 years ago, not too long ago, up here in New England, where there's 70 plus Division III schools, and you could probably help me out. I would say a handful, 20%, 30% were full-time soccer coaches. Yeah, other coach was part-time.
It was pretty much the NESCACs, and I think it's still today, to this day. It's pretty much the NESCACs, and maybe NUMAC schools will have full-time coaches, but... You know, even if there are all those two conferences I note are full time, there's still a whole heck of a lot, or predominantly, that are not full time.
Yeah, back then. And now, I mean, today, I mean, they're all full time. Most of them today they are. Mm. And you know, the opportunity came. I left teaching for a year to be the coach at Clemson. My assistant coach at Clemson got the head job at Stetson University in Florida. I left teaching and I went down there for a year to be they offered me some grad credit and some living expense and whatnot. And I thought, you know, this is the way to do it, be a Division I coach, as Sean Murphy was the coach at the time. And I went down there and, you know, he kind of mapped out a real, a lifestyle that wasn't really the lifestyle I think I wanted. You know, he was, he was an assistant coach at Clemson University. Then he was at Stetson. He was the head coach at Stetson, which was in DeLand, Florida. Very nice place. It's outside of Orlando, I'd say. And he was just telling me one night, you know, like, this is what you got to do. You got to do this. And then you're going to try to be an assistant at a big school. And then you're going to start at a small school in the middle of nowhere. And I just thought, you know, that's not the path I want. That's not the lifestyle I want. And, you know, I just said, listen, you know, so I just headed back up north. And then I got the job at Emerson. And it's, you know, that was awesome. You know, and then that really changed my life there.
You know, your story, Jared, and I've known you for a lot of years, and this particular chronology I was not aware of, but our stories are very much the same. My original career intent, kind of ironically, was radio and TV broadcasting. That was my intent all the way up to my senior year in high school, never knowing that someday here I'd be behind a microphone, but that's a different story. And then I discovered one day that I could teach physical education and coach soccer. I remember having a conversation with my physical education teachers. I'm like, how does this work? You know, how does this work, this phys ed thing and this coaching thing work? One of my phys ed teachers was the wrestling coach at the high school. And he kind of laid out the groundwork. I'm like, well, I can get paid for, you know, being a physical education teacher. I can coach soccer. And I did. I started my career at Weymouth North High School in my hometown of Weymouth, Mass. And it was great. And it was just a great thing. And also in similar fashion, when I left being a high school coach, my first college gig was at Massachusetts Maritime Academy down in Buzzards Bay. And it was the only time in my life, Jared, where, you know, I'm like, I think I want to do this college soccer thing, you know, full time. And I came to a very stark reality early on when I had applied for a couple of smaller Division I schools in different parts of the country, where I came to the realization, well, wait a minute, I'm going to have to move out of New England. This whole Division I thing is a different animal altogether. I don't want to be a gypsy where, as you described, you know, you got to go here and work for a couple of years and then work yourself up the ladder and then move someplace else. I didn't want to do that. And I remember the moment I had that internal conversation. You know what? New England's not a bad place to be. You can build a soccer career here in the Boston area. And you and I are living proof of that. And quote unquote, the rest is history. The rest is history, you know?
Yeah. I think I was you know, naive at the time. I think I was 27, maybe 26 at the time. Not too naive, but naive enough. But I had an interesting taste of being in the Division III realm and then going to the Division I realm. And I think you got to be cut out. You know, they're different. They really are different. And I loved Division III soccer. I felt it was a more equal playing field. 100% a more equal playing field at that time. I don't know what it is now. As far as, you know, we were not fully funded versus teams that were fully funded. I mean, we were at Stetson just, you know, we were making it work. But, you know, you're coming from the ACC, you're coming from this. You really back then didn't have a chance against those teams. You just didn't. And... you know, in the D3 realm, where I think the soccer was very quality, this isn't about the soccer at all. I felt that the truth is almost any team can beat any team because there isn't scholarships there. You do have to coach. You do have to develop players. You have to, you know, take a kid that's a 6 and hopefully make him an 8, out of that time or whatever. And those aren't positions, you know, a scale is what I'm talking about, out of 10. You know, you got to do that because that's who's at your school, you know, who came, who you recruited, you know, those type of things. So, and I really enjoyed that more personally, you know, than the Division I was a lot of man management, which all of college is man management, a lot of man management there because everyone is a star at that time. And the bottom line is there's only 11. there's only 11 stars that are gonna play a significant amount, or 14 if you really, to be honest. So it was eye opening.
So let's stay in that college coach conversation, if you will, and in particular your time at Emerson. So you're a high school social studies teacher at Masconomet, but you're a mm-hmm. part-time coach at Emerson College. And again, our stories mirror one another. I was the same thing. I was a teacher in Weymouth and a college coach in a number of different areas. Share with my audience those challenges, of being a high school teacher and then having to get in your car every afternoon and driving into Boston, in the case of Emerson, and dealing with, being a part-time coach. How did you manage all that?
Well, I always start that by saying an understanding wife. At the very beginning, I was married. I had just gotten married, right around the same time of getting the job. I had no children at the very beginning. School would end at 3 o'clock by the time I could get out, 3 o'clock. I would drive in. And at the time, my wife and I were living in the city. All right. We were a little apartment, a little studio apartment. So that was pretty easy because I had a parking pass. And parking pass is critical to the whole story. All right. I had a parking pass, but it was in Back Bay. So I would park there. I would then take the T up to the campus at Emerson. All right. My first 2 years at Emerson, I would get there and we would practice sometimes at 7, 8-ish at night at East Boston Field. So we would then take vans that were parked underneath the common, 3 to 4 of them. Each of them would be, you'd have to go through the toll. I would reimburse the guys once they gave me the ticket when we got on the other side. The guys would lose the ticket somehow in a tunnel. And I'm like, well, then you don't get reimbursed. The school would reimburse me. All right, for that. We would then practice, let's just say 7 to 9 or 8 to 10. We would then get back in the vans, go do this. I would take the green line back over to Back Bay and then repeat and then be up again at 6, get in, if not before, drive up here to the North Shore, this, that, the other, and teach. And I did that for the first 2 years, I think. Then I think we moved out of the city and we moved up to the North Shore. And at the same time, Emerson got a new field, which was in Albany, the South End on Albany Street. Okay, Roch Playground, where they play now. So that was a little simpler in the fact that I had really strategic time. Either we practiced from 5 to 7 or 7 to 9 there. But it would be the same. If you practice at 5, it, because of traffic, I pretty much just had to leave when school ended at 3 o'clock. Even if I had a 7 o'clock practice, I'd get there early, do a little bit of work, eat, be ready to go. You had 5, there you go. You had to get in, and you got in. I would do that. And I did that for, 12 years, 10 there, but 12 years. And I guess I didn't know any better. I only knew when it stopped that was insane. And pretty much, I remember when I had my final conversation with the AD because the job went full time and she was sitting down thinking that this was going to be a tough conversation, which I really appreciate her for that. And I just stopped her at the very beginning and I just said, thank you. Thank you for making this full time. Thank you for doing this. Because I probably would have never stopped. And the truth was, for the 4 months in the fall, when my kids were young, they only saw me on Sunday. And you know the time commitment for game days, and you played every Saturday. And they would come, my wife would bring them in the stroller and this, that, the other. But I absolutely did not put my children down Monday through Friday. Because, they go to bed around 7 or, they go to bed early. And I was gone. And they didn't see me. Do I look back now? My kids are 16 and 14 now. They came out all right. Do I look back now thinking I missed something in their life? No regrets here, none of that. And they don't, despise me or any of those things like that. But that was a lot. That was a lot. And that was a lot of work. And I didn't know it until I left. But I loved every minute of it. Emerson's a real special place. It's a very unique place. And I always say when it stopped, I actually had a couple of opportunities for other part-time jobs in Boston. And I actually got one. And I thought long and hard. And I said, I loved Emerson. I was, and one former player said this, I was the right coach at Emerson at the right time. And I think that's true. I was. And I just enjoyed the type of student athlete I recruited. I enjoyed the challenges that the school had, the challenges with field. We only had eight majors, all right? Communication arts school, you know, top shelf film, top shelf audio, radio, TV, all of that, theater. Not a lot of tough to find soccer players. Tough to find soccer players at that time. Since then, they've opened up to sports communication, which I think would have been, I would have enjoyed that a little more. Easier to recruit. But it was a real unique place. And I think you had to really appreciate the type of student athlete you got there. You know, somebody said to me, you know, after I left that, you know, the teams I had, I think, you know, I really got the most out of those guys. And I will never take anything away from those guys. They were great soccer players and great guys and gave 100% and knew how to compete. I think now they get, Emerson had a great year this year. They really get soccer guys. And I think the challenge is you now need to teach them how to compete. All right. You don't need to teach them soccer. You have to teach them how to compete. And there I had to teach them soccer. They knew how to compete. They were going to give me 110 no matter what they had, which I loved. And they knew that. So it was a real special place. And I think a lot of coaches say that in all this, you know, wherever their travels are. But Emerson is clearly a unique school. It really is. It is a communication arts school. There's probably only a handful in the country that can claim that title. It's not an engineering school. It's not a liberal arts school. All right. And it's right in the city. So you have to find a student athlete that wants one of those majors, wants to also be in the city, all right, and can play some soccer. All right. And that is, I don't want to say it's needle in a haystack, but they're there, but it is, it's a challenge. And they've since opened up some majors, which I think have helped you know, be able, you know, their team now is all sports communication majors. My team was all, you know, mostly film majors, and we had a consortium with Berklee College of Music. So I had a lot of Berklee players on the team also. They no longer have that consortium of classes, so the kids from Berklee can't play anymore. But I had drum majors and I don't know what they were. Musicians. They were musicians. They were incredible musicians, but they were great soccer players too, the kids from Berklee.
You know, so in your description there, Jared, I mean, it's talk about eating up time. Oh. You know, there's 24 hours in a day, there's 7 days a week, there's 365 days in a year. And you know, listening to you know your story there, just the transportation part, just the transportation part, ate up so much time, and then the time you know you're training your team, and then this time for matches and time additional time for away matches, and then all the things that go along with that. And you mentioned recruiting; it was kind of my next talking point here. Where did you find time and how did you manage your time to recruit at a school, which is a niche school? How did you manage your time to effectively get out there and get players? Because it's, if you're going to be a college coach, it kind of comes with the territory. Share with my audience how you manage that.
So the recruiting was a challenge. You know, we didn't have, we had assistant coaches, but, you know, they got a minimal stipend. You know, you couldn't be sending them all around the place. So, you know, a lot of the recruiting was, you know, as kids, I encourage kids to do that. It's self-recruiting. You know, they send you the email, they send you the video, you call them on the phone. I would spend nights here, you know, at my house on the phone, calling them. The other part was this, you know, I look at other schools like liberal arts schools that say, you know, they get 400-500 inquiries a year. At a place like Emerson, because it's so unique, I would get maybe 50 to 60 inquiries, all right, which isn't a lot. But you can curate those and figure out who is interested and who isn't. And by the end, let's just stick with our number of 60. You kind of push out, you know, 15 of those retire kickers. But most of the kids who I recruited, Emerson was their top choice. The question is, could you get in? All right, that was it. Could you get in with the portfolio? Could you get in with your, you know, if you wanted to be there for film, you had to submit a film, you know, some type of, you know, I don't know, a film or whatnot. And that weighed more than your SATs. It weighed more than your GPA. You know, this was not some backyard handy cam type of thing. It had to be really quality. That is made. So I was really only curating around 40, 45 players a year that I could really give that attention to. And I felt that was really the key to my recruiting success, is that I was going to be different from other places, that I was going to call them. I was going to, when they weren't home and I called them and mom and dad spoke up, I had mom and dad's name. Oh, hi, Paula. How are you? You know, this, that, the other, chit chat. Yeah. Oh, Jim's not in, you know, really personal touch on that stuff. Handwritten letters. I would send them. I knew, you know, that I had to do something different, that the traditional liberal art dime dozen college was doing. And that allowed me to, let's just say, of the 50, 30 would apply. All right. And remember, I'm dealing with guys that if they get in, they're coming. All right. 15 get accepted. Okay. And of the 15, let's say anywhere between 8 and 10 come. There's your recruiting class. And that's a challenge. That was a challenge. There was a year, and I'll never forget it. You played against me. My goalie graduated. It wasn't a surprise. I have been doing everything I can to get a goalie. All right. And I couldn't. I mean, I had recruited this many. I was just anybody. I didn't have a goalie. And I remember saying to the group of guys, you know, in the huddle, who would like to play goalie? I mean, can you imagine that?
And
Galen Wilk, I'll never forget, and I never forget him. He said, "Coach, I'll give it a go." And he was our goalie, and we still made the GNAC playoffs that year.
Yeah.
You know, other than that, it was a challenge. But you know, we built the culture up, we built the team up. And the recruiting kind of went like that. Yeah, I would go out to tournaments, but, you know, going to a tournament, how many kids at Lancaster, 16 fields, let's just say, fit that profile? And how was I going to know that kid? Walking up to a kid and being like, hey, you're thinking about being a film major? Hey, you're thinking about communication disorders? All right. Are you thinking about theater? Or how about writing literature and publishing? You interested in that? You know, you're what are you doing right now? You know, that is not, that's not how to do it. So I just really curated the players that were interested in me. I was interested in you. And yeah, you might say, well, what was their ability like? Well, they, you know, they had a soccer resume. You had to call their coach. You know, they had film. You know, so you had to make some decisions. You know, if this kid's all state in Connecticut, let's just be honest, he's probably really good. All right, well, I'm interested. So, you know, it wasn't as hard sometimes as it was hard to maybe recruit, let's just say, the next level of player. But, you know, we had some great players. You know, I had some all New England players there and they were there. But the recruiting was tough in the off season when it came down to that. And we had so many players from L.A. And that made it very difficult. And Emerson, you know, God bless him. They, you know, I pretty much had an unlimited recruiting budget. Emerson might disagree with that, but they pretty much allowed me to do whatever I want. We have a campus in LA. They have such a, there's so many kids from the LA, New York City region, because that's where the entertainment industry is, Florida. They would say, yeah, go out there and try to find players and things like that. They were really supportive. They were really supportive. We also had a recruiting coordinator, Stan Nance, who was great at that time too.
So your approach, you know, and I don't think this is an oversimplification, was quality over quantity. You know, you talked about, you know, that personal touch, that the handwritten letters, the conversations you had with mom or dad when, you know, the recruit wasn't at home. That's quality recruiting versus quantity, where you can just, you know, okay, I got 500 legitimate names on a database. No, you've got 50 or 60 legitimate names on a database, of which, as you noted, you know, 10, 15, you just got to get rid of right off the top. So if you don't do a quality job, if you don't make it personal, you're toast. You're toast.
Yeah, it was really unique in that fact, and the fact that I didn't really know any better, to be honest with you. You know, because I got it right coming out of Stetson, and Stetson was, again, Division One, a different type of recruiting. We are looking for just the best, you know, the best we can at that time. And, you know, I had done some I'd done some recruiting at Endicott and places like that. And that was, again, very different. And, you know, I was the assistant there, where you don't really ask much of the assistants when you're getting a couple grand. You know, you put all the time in the fall and you kind of say thanks. You know what I mean? It's right. Really up to the head coach to do that. So it is that. It was that quality. And I felt that I had to come up with a different approach. You know, the people that wanted me, I wanted them.
Well, you know, the proof's in the pudding. You spent 11 years at Emerson and you were highly successful. I know firsthand because I saw your teams firsthand. So your approach, it certainly worked and worked well. So from there, you go to the high school level and you make a transition, so to speak, to the high school level. Share with my audience, Jared, some of the challenges, issues, if there were any, from going to that college routine, that college environment, that college mindset, the college approach, to being a high school teacher, and not only a high school teacher, but the classic teacher coach, because you were coaching at the school where you serve as a social studies teacher. How did that all? What were the challenges that you faced in that transition?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it was a pretty unique opportunity to get the job at the high school where I was. There was a teacher there, a teacher coach who coached for 40 plus years. Then there was a coach that coached for like 5 or 6 years, really successful. And then at the same, literally the next fall, you know, the fall at Emerson, at the end of that season, we just decided it's going to go full time. So I was kind of not planning on coaching. And then that coach stepped down and I was like, well, why don't I try high school? The first thing for me that was just the biggest stunner, as you talk about the time and the traffic, was I literally walked out of the door and there was 3 soccer fields right then and there. I mean, just, you know, a state of shock where I walked across the parking lot and there they are. They're right on campus. That was amazing. And I'll never forget coming home at 5 o'clock after practice. And I was, it took me at least 2 years to my body to understand that I am done for the day at 5, not continuing the day. But some of the challenges were that the way I was very fortunate. I've been very fortunate to have the JV coach and the freshman coach at they are both also social studies teachers. They have both been with the program and they are both very good coaches. They have their licenses. I am super lucky to have those guys with me. They're incredible teachers and incredible coaches. But the way I wanted to approach it was that we really have one program. You know, I took the college coach and used that sort of terminology that it's the Mascaromet soccer program. It's not the varsity team. It's not the JV team. It's or the freshman team. It's the program. All right. There's 60 kids in the program. You know, that varies anywhere between 60 and we've had up to 75, whatever. We try to keep as many kids. Our philosophy is to keep as many kids playing soccer as long as they can. The toughest thing is always to cut a kid, to tell them that their soccer career is over. It is brutal. I've done it. And that is a challenge, for sure. That was one of the biggest challenges, was that you have to have these tough conversations. Just because they're, you know, in a lot of it's logistics and some of it's culture. And, you know, every kid wants to be a member of the team on August 28th when it's 85 degrees, but when it's October 28th and it's 30 degrees and you've played 4 minutes all year, they're not happy. All right. So and they don't know that. And that's them being a kid. I do know that. So kind of challenging. That was sort of the biggest challenge. The parental piece has been a challenge. Was a big challenge for me. just kind of, you know, parents are a part of the equation. In college, they are certainly not. Was a little bit of a challenge for sure. And then I think kind of understanding that not all high schools sort of operate really under the same, or high school coaches, you know, I tried to make it as, you know, I run the team like a college team, you know, warm up, practice, you know, training t-shirts. You know, we have a certain routine that we do before every game, every practice, you know, all of those kind of collegiate things that soccer related. We do a bunch of high school things too that are really fun. Not that, that isn't fun either, but that was a little challenge. That it's not that's not how every other all high schools operate, and you have to kind of understand that you know those high schools are dealing with their different sizes, different coaches, different you know, there's a difference between city schools and suburban schools. I mean, there's all types of differences, and sort of understanding how that all operates is that the refereeing is unique.
Hold that thought, my friend, because I got some boxes to check. Hold that one, but go ahead. I there's some things I want you to get your comments on, and that's certainly at the top of my list.
Is unique for sure. And the facilities are certainly unique right there. And ours being one of them, and everyone is shocked when they come to Masconama. We play on grass fields. We're probably one of the last on the North Shore that doesn't have a turf field. And there are no locker rooms. That's the other thing. There's no locker rooms. You're just out on the field for soccer games. You know, I will also say that, I think there's a lot of positives too, you know, and I don't know if you're going to ask me that. I really enjoy it. You know, there's a little stripped downness to the game of, listen, let's just go out there and play. There's a little less pomp and circumstance that sometimes goes around with the college game, which is great in some level, but sometimes let's just play the game. All right. We're not there an hour and a half before. I mean, we're sometimes with the current bus situation after COVID, we're lucky if we're there on time. Last year, I did not start a game on time all year. And when I say not on time, I'm not talking five. I'm talking the closest I got was 15 minutes after, and the furthest I got was 50 minutes after. So you have to adjust that, you know, and that's a challenge. You know, I look at the college game. I mean, we were regimented. I mean, to the minute. At this minute, we pull off the field. At this minute, we say the anthem. At this minute, we do that. I mean, it was, and I liked that, you know, personally. I liked that. So those were some of the challenges. But the challenge wasn't coaching the kids. The kids were great. The kids have been great. And I've been fortunate enough to have some successful teams with a lot of kids who, I mean, the Masco program has always been successful for the last 50 years. But every year, there are at least anywhere between 3 and 4 seniors that go on to play in college. There's probably another 2 that could play at college, but, you know, go to, you know, big university. So, you know, you back that down to the juniors and sophomores on the team. There are easily 10 to 13 collegiate level players in front of me, hands down. So I'm blessed in that transition.
So the last time I coached high school soccer was way back in the 1980s, is where I started my career at Weymouth North High School, as I noted to you, and this resonates with you. But as a college coach, you see countless high school games because it's part of the recruiting process. And even though I'm not a head coach anymore over at Regis, I still get out there and help with the recruiting process. I still like to get out there and watch high school games. I like the high school environment. You kind of touched upon that in your answer. There's something about the purity, maybe I'm naive by using that word, the purity of high school sports. I just kind of like that. But over the years, even when I was a head coach and still currently going out there and looking for players for Regis College, you know, there are issues that, you know, with little hair I have left, Jared, I continue to pull out. And for whatever reason, and there's no specific reason, last fall, I went to a lot of high school games. I spent a lot of time out there, you know, watching games. And there were the issues rearing their most ugly heads again. And I and people who listen to my show know that last season I went on a rant, and then I devoted an entire show to the high school rant, and I offered up my 2 cents as to if Giovanni Pacini was in charge, this is what he would do, and got some terrific responses back, quite frankly. And so I want to run some things past you, and I want to kind of get your feedback and your thoughts on some of these things as now a high school coach and a successful high school coach. Now, you touched upon the officiating. Now, let me start by saying the following. This is not personal. And when I went on a rant a couple of seasons ago about high school soccer, I always say this is not personal. The people who go out and officiate high school sports, God bless them. They're not making a lot of money. They work a lot because there's not a lot of people who want to be officials, but they're out there. So let me put the personal part aside and just stick to the nuts and bolts of officiating. Things that drive me crazy, the dual system, two people officiating, you know how this works. And for the life of me, I don't understand how one guy, the far official can make a call in front of the near officials, part of the field, 50, 60 yards away. And how did he see that? That makes me crazy. The referee's inability to understand what is appropriately physical in the sport of soccer makes me bonkers. I see more times than I can tell you, Jared, where two kids go shoulder to shoulder. One kid goes down because, he went down, nothing illegal, and the referee blows the whistle. Slide tackles, which when done correctly, I think is an art form, being called, for tripping. The misuse of yellow cards because officials don't have the managerial skills to manage players and to manage situations so as to avoid the issuance of a yellow card. Now, there are times when it's appropriate, and heck, when they're appropriate, they're appropriate. But I find far too often that they're used, misappropriately, if you will. And there's a rant. You heard my voice raising as I start to spill those. What are your thoughts on all these things? Let me add one more, and I apologize for this. Haunting. And I got to, and I shared the story with you in Philly, and I got to share with my audience to kind of set the table here. Make a long story short, I went to a high school game last fall. The two teams shall remain nameless. One team had not won a game. One team had only had won one game. So this was a battle for, let's try to get out of last place. Back and forth, 0-0. And in the very, very last few moments of the game, the one team scored, the team that had won one game all year had scored a late goal. And, oh, man, they erupted with joy. You saw a bunch of high school kids. You thought they'd won the World Cup. I felt great for them. The one of the referees went over when they settled down and kind of collected them and issued a yellow card. I didn't know what had happened. I didn't hear any swearing because I was on the near side there. I didn't hear any swearing. I didn't see anything that could constitute being, poor behavior. So I went to the coach who I kind of knew. And I said, Coach, can I ask you a question? I said, you got a yellow card after you scored a goal. What was that? What was happening? Did somebody swear or something? He says, no, we got a yellow card for taunting. I said, taunting? He says, yeah, we celebrated too much. I just lost it. In my own head, I kind of lost it. And I did a little bit of research and I found that this idea of taunting is something that needs to be managed, and they flash yellow cards because kids are being kids. What are your thoughts on all this, Jared? Enlighten me, put it in perspective.
There's a lot to unpack there.
There is. I ranted. I rant. I admittedly ranted.
A few things I can tell you that are a little bit more, that I would say have to change. One, I feel that the pay has changed. I mean, they get like $87 a game. And I just told you that none of the games start on time. But I will say the ref comes on time. And he doesn't get any more. All right? He doesn't get any more when he's sitting there. And a lot of it is bus related, but it's becoming a problem. But I would say, one, we need to pay them more. Their job is more important than $87. Over an hour and a half of time, which is more than an hour and a half of time. That's just, they're actually, let's just say, working, but that I'm not sure. They're early. They stay a few minutes late. You know, after all of that. As far as the two-man system, I hear you, but we all know, and I'm sure you could do a show on this, the ref shortage is a crisis mode. It's in crisis mode. You couldn't do a three-man system. You couldn't. There aren't enough humans. Every sub-varsity game only has a ref, one ref. It's just one there. Now let's get into the physical play and the yellow cards. Yellow cards are tough. I mean, I think for the most part, we're pretty good on the yellow card front up here. We have a lot of you see the same faces. They're not quick draw McGraw over here. I think my team's pretty, they understand that, MIA has the rule where if you get a yellow card, you have to be subbed out. All right. I think sometimes that might be a good thing, but it's automatic. On my team, they all know if you get a yellow card for language, any type of language, John with the ref, you drop an F bomb, you're out for the game. You're off of the game. You don't go back in because you can control your mouth. That's the rule. You can control your mouth. A hard tackle, slide tackle, physical play. No, you just go right back in like that. I get that. That's part of the game, right? That's it. Sometimes you come in a little late. I hear you. I get it. But any of your mouth, you sit the rest of the game, and everybody knows that. Like it's not. And I will ask the ref at that time. Is this for dissent? If they say yes, that kid's head is down and he's not happy. And I'm like, well, you made your bet. All right. On that one, the taunting, I don't know if I've ever seen that. And I'm not sure what to say to that. It does probably fall under sportsmanship. I have never, granted, I've only been, eight years or so, been coaching the high school. I don't think I've ever seen anyone give a yellow card for taunting. I know that, I was an athletic director at Masco while teaching there for 5 years, too. Taunting is a big issue within the MIA. They don't want any of it. They don't want any of it. I mean, you cannot have any signage, for MIA state games. You cannot have a kid holding a sign that says, "Go Giovanni." Nope. No signage. All right. Because next thing you know, it says something that's inappropriate. And I'm like, well, I hear you, but there's a clear difference between me holding a sign that mocks you and me holding a sign that promotes you. I've always sort of had an issue with that the MIA didn't give kind of local control over signage because it's all about taunting and sportsmanship. And I'm for sportsmanship. I was on the MIA sportsmanship committee for years. So I get that. But the ref situation is, to me, more about the lack of refs and I'm sure you could do, or maybe already have done, an episode. It is a crisis. It's not a problem. It is a crisis. So how do we get young refs in? The ones we have are certainly aging out. And the way they assign the refs are, the best refs get the varsity games and so forth for the most part. You kind of go down. Maybe they train some refs in the JV and sub varsity games there. But it's a tough scene down there in sub varsity world. It is a tough scene sometimes down there.
I'm not naive. Yeah. I'm certainly well aware of the deficiency in the officials. I talked last season on HBO on the show. It's called Real Sports with Brian Gumbel. They did a whole segment on this very issue.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I saw that.
Very, very, very well done. I would share with my listening audience to check that out. And when you see the segment, to Jared's point, who would want to do that? The kind of abuse, not just verbal abuse, but this physical abuse that's taking place. Who the heck would want to do that for $87? I probably should have put a little caveat before my rant on the dual system, knowing full well that there is a deficiency. Let me save the best for last. Jared, where did timeouts come from? What is with these timeouts? There's no timeouts in soccer, full stop.
The timeouts, I actually don't know, okay, where they came from. I believe it's just Massachusetts. I don't think it's national, National Federation of High School Sports there. Yeah. Is that the governing body of that that kind of sets rules for all sports? The timeouts drive me, they kind of drive me insane a little bit because here's the thing. Here's the thing about our sport. I mean, I can't believe I'm going to tell you about this. But part of it is, and you know this, that we don't have the opportunity to coach you in the middle of the game. We can't, you know, there's a foul in basketball and we huddle up and we're going to run this play and, you know, we're going to inbound it this way. Or football, which is just all plays. And so lacrosse has a lot. I mean, part of our gig as a sport is you have to train them for situations that are going to occur in the game. And it's up to them, the player, to recognize those situations and make the right decision. That's the gig. That's the gig. I don't get the opportunity to say, hey, let's stop. Here's the situation. Remember, we talked about it. This, that, and the other. To me, that's part of the beauty and flow of the game there. So the timeouts to me are really... they always talk about the pureness of the game, and they bring up remember the MLS, the 35-yard.
Sure.
That wasn't soccer. Timeouts to me are not soccer. I used to think they might have been a safety thing. If it was across the country, something like that, where it's really, really hot in Texas or something. I don't know. Then they would have just broken the game up into quarters, which, okay, that almost seems better to me. Both, even though there are 2-minute timeouts, you get one each half and both sides come over to the sideline and give a quick huddle. I am not a fan of them, to say the least. I am not a fan of timeouts at all.
Yeah, I say, and I said it on my show during my high school rant episode, that if I was a high school coach ever again, and I have no intention of being a high school coach, but if I was a high school coach, I would never call a timeout. Yeah. And if my opposing coach called a timeout, I wouldn't have told my players, you stay in the field. You do not come to the sideline because there are no timeouts in soccer.
I've only called it once, and it's a long story there, but I've only called one once. And they come over and just get a drink. And I don't really know, and I'll tell you, here's what I can tell you about timeouts. They are effective. All right. Oh. As one who doesn't call them and gets them, let's just say, called on them. Oftentimes they are called when my team, Masconomet, has momentum. And it stuns your momentum.
Sure.
It's effective.
And it shouldn't stun momentum. That's soccer.
Correct.
That's soccer. You train your team how to deal with dealing with all that, you know?
Yes.
We're under the gun. This is how we deal with being under the gun.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. So are they effective in altering the game?
For all the wrong reasons.
Correct. They are. They are.
Well, listen, let's shift gears. Let's get out of this because I have very little hair left and I've already pulled out a handful. I am fascinated in looking through your resume. You created a course called Sports, Society, and Culture. Share with my audience what that's all about. That is terribly fascinating to me.
Okay. So here's the course here. So it's a half year course. It stemmed from my time at Clemson. All right. So it's my senior year, and I had to take, to graduate with a history degree, a 400 level course. All right. And they were all offering at the time 400 level courses that I thought were boring. There was a 300 level course called Sports and Society. So I go to the professor and I said, listen, I'd like to take your course, but I need it to be 400 level. And, he kind of smiles at me and he says, all right, well, here's what you can do. You can take the course, take it as an independent study, which was 400 level. So I had to go to all the classes and he goes, you're going to read these two books, which I'll never forget. So this is my senior year. And then give me a little paper on the books. They were two books on soccer. He knew I played soccer. And on like politics and culture and soccer in Brazil. One was called Soccer Madness by, I think, Janet Lever. And another one by Tony Mason. All right. And first, I never even knew that genre of book existed, a history political soccer book. So I was like floored, loved it. So I took the course, loved the course. The course was about sport and society. So we learned about all types of that, which I'll get into. And then I started teaching at Masco and they were asking for electives. Does anyone want to do one? I said, yeah, I'd like to give this a whirl. So, you know, everyone was like, well, that sounds pretty cool. And so I modeled it off of the college course that I took. And what we do is look at like the politics of the Olympics, like the 72 Olympics in Montreal. We look at sport, like, you know, obviously there's a unit on soccer in the World Cup, obviously who the teacher is. We look at gender in sport and what that's been all about. We look about race in sport, and what that's all been about throughout history. And, we look at the question of what, like, you know, what is a sport, like pigeon racing and things like that, and kind of have some fun with that. So it's a really, it's a fun course, that, you know, we look at really sport in politics. Think of, exactly, we watch a lot of clips from, Real Sport, you know, HBO, yeah. You know, segments from that. There's a lot of great stuff on YouTube, obviously, now. So we watch a lot of clips. And we look at, you know, in basketball and on Native American reservations is really unique there. And then we sort of look at life on Native American reservations and what that's all about in society there. So it's really cool. It's fun. It's a fun class. I think the kids are a little surprised, that, you know, sport has so much to do, with society, and it isn't just for athletes at the school. It's anybody wants to take it. It's open to anybody. It's not a college, and it's been fun. It's been fun to kind of and I don't know many high schools that sort of offer that and had given me the chance to create that course, which is pretty neat.
Well, that's a teacher in me coming out because it caught my eye because you know when you hear about social studies, you see more of the traditional social studies type courses. And reading through your resume, I'm like, well, I have never seen that. I've seen similar things at the college level, but not at a high school for a high school course. And you're right. You're spot on. You know, kids are, even whether they're athletes or not, they're aware of sports. Mm-hmm. But I think a lot of them aren't aware of the impact sports have in our society and culture. And I have often said when I've made comments here on the show that many, 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 many times, more than most people might realize, sports and politics collide, sports and societal issues collide, sports and culture collide more times than people realize. Sports, and I'm preaching to the choir here, sports oftentimes there's a platform there, you know, to address social issues, of which, you know, there are numerous. So kudos to you, my friend. Kudos to you. I think that's terrific. Absolutely terrific.
Thanks. It's been fun.
Yeah. So last but not least, let's share with my audience a little bit here about Ironsides Soccer Consulting. What is that all about?
So a friend of mine, Mike Singleton, you might know Mike Singleton, the coach down at Washington Lee. Obviously, we grew up together up here in Beverly and Danvers. And I was the coach at MIT for a while. So just a really close friend of mine. Him and I just kind of started a little LLC, if you will, a little business, in which what we do is just, you know, he kind of runs it through. He runs his ID camp business through there, down there in Washington and Lee, down there in Virginia. And I run through it. I run a summer high school soccer league here, and I do some camps and clinics up here. But we also both do, we've taken our 20 plus years of being involved in college and help kids and families navigate the college process, you know, help recruit themselves and, you know, sort of navigate all of those things. So that's really what Ironsides Soccer does, is that we help navigate the college process. And as vice president of Aztec, which you had mentioned, Aztec Club Soccer, I'm also the director of Boys College Placement. So, you know, I just help families just navigate a lot of the things that we've talked about. And, you know, it's their first or second child, or, you know, they've never played the sports. And how does that work? And getting in touch with a college coach and, you know, putting together a highlight video and a resume and just beating the drum. And social media is really a big piece of recruiting now. That's it's big. Kids have to have a social media presence that's appropriate, which, you know, takes some education right there. And so that's part of the job there, is just kind of helping out families navigate the process, you know, navigate the path, as I like to call it, the path.
Yeah, you know, now arguably now more than ever, as you indicated, with because of, you know, social media.
Yeah.
You know, part of our jobs when you and I were coaching way back in the day, we used to help with the navigation. You know, we used to help parents because it was part of the recruiting process. You'd have to bring parents in, and if they could come in and or chat on the phone, or, well, this is how financial aid works, and this is how the admissions process works, and this difference between Division I, II, III, or JUCO, and, you know, those types of things. And whether we knew it or not, you know, we're our own little self-sustaining navigation vehicle, if you will, to help parents. But now more than ever, and you're doing it firsthand here with Ironside Soccer Consulting, that there's a formal approach now where parents can go, oh, I can go there. They can help me with this process. Because it can be overwhelming. It can be absolutely overwhelming.
It absolutely is. And I can tell you that the college process, as one who's, I've got a junior, my son is a junior, and going through it as a parent, and I would say I'm an educated parent. All right. My wife is also a teacher. We're in the business, let's just say. It is overwhelming. I can't imagine what it's like not being in the business, in this all being all first time, whether you're playing or not playing. The process is, it's not getting any easier for people to go to college. I can tell you that.
The cost factor alone.
Yeah.
It's insane. You know, it's insane.
Insane.
50, 60, 70, 80, 90,000 plus dollars a year.
I am waiting. It will be soon, my friend. There will be a school. It might be out there. There's going to be a six-figure school.
Oh,
someone is going to – I think they're all teetering at like $9.99. You know what I mean? But it's going to happen. And I think it's shocking to me. It's shocking. But it's not just the financial piece. Filling out financial aid forms is astounding.
It is.
Right? You need a college degree to fill out the form.
It's so true. It just says, listen, man, I'm not a head. I haven't been a head coach for a few years. I don't miss any of that. I don't miss any of that. It's a necessary evil when you're a head coach and you're recruiting. You got to do it. But my goodness gracious me, not anymore. You know, I'm a little older than you. I always like to tell people, particularly kids, you know, that I'm coaching now over at Regis. I say, you know, I was a college freshman in the fall of 1976. Ooh. First of all, I have to get their head. They go, what? 1976? I'm like, yeah, it was a few years ago. I said, do you know what my first semester's tuition was? Now, I went to Boston State College on Huntington Avenue. I was a commuter. I was a commuter school, majored in physical education. So I'd ask him, you know, what do you think I paid for my first semester's tuition? And they, you know, thousand here, thousand there. And I would go, and I, the proverbial pregnant pause, Jared, I'd go, $295. And they go, no. I'm like, yep.
First semester,
$295, state school, Boston State College. I will never, ever, ever, ever forget that number. And I think when I graduated 4 years later, it was like $400-something. It was dirt cheap. I mean, dirt cheap. Again, commuter school, state school. You know, it wasn't an elite school by any stretch of the imagination. So yeah, it was $295. You know, I could work in the summer. I worked at my parents' business and could make my tuition up in a couple of weeks, and it was done. It was done. Now $295 doesn't get you a couple of books. It's insane.
Yeah, it's yeah. You know, anyone who tells me that they paid for their semesters with their summer job, that is not the case anymore.
That is not.
I don't know
case.
What summer job that is, but if you could keep it, just keep that job. Don't go to college.
Well, listen, Jared. Listen, I want to formally say thank you very much for taking the time for being on the GP Soccer Podcast. I've so enjoyed our hour or so here together. I think we could keep going. And goodness knows when we see each other face to face, albeit infrequently, but we have these kind of conversations. You are indeed a highly respected friend and colleague. It's such a joy to have you on my show. I hope you will come back. So again, many thanks for being on the GP Soccer Podcast.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me. It's been great, as always.
And if people want to learn more about Ironsides, or they want to learn more about Aztec Soccer Club, what's the best way to learn about all of that stuff?
Just head to ironsidesoccer.com or aztecsoccer.com. That's it.
And there you have it. There you have it. So again, ladies and gentlemen, my guest today, my friend, Jared Scarpacci. So you know how this all works now, don't you, folks? You could probably predict it. We're going to break for a commercial or two. We're going to re-engage on the other side. Don't you dare go anywhere, because you know what happens. You know what I'm going to say. I will hunt you down. In the Soccer Coach's Toolkit, those who teach the game will find a wealth of coaching activities to improve, stimulate, and provide enjoyment for players of all ages and abilities. UEFA B licensed coach and Chelsea FC Player Development Center head coach Rob Ellis has drawn on more than 20 years of soccer coaching and physical education teaching experience to provide only those activities he has successfully used time and time again to engage and inspire his players. Each activity is graded from beginner to advanced, and they foster fresh and exciting ideas to coach the main techniques and tactics of soccer. The 252 coaching activities included in the Soccer Coach's Toolkit are also accompanied by an easy-to-understand description and diagram. The activities require only basic coaching equipment and can be adapted to challenge players of varying ability levels and needs. Soccer coaches at all levels of the game can use the activities to create one-off sessions for their players or use the activities to deliver regular sessions as part of a competitive training program. It is an ideal resource for both grassroots and elite youth coaches and will enhance both the players' and team's development. The book is on sale worldwide and has scored a massive hit with professional coaches and players alike. Former Tottenham Hotspur youth coach John Rowan described the Soccer Coach's Toolkit as an astounding book. I consider it the Bible of soccer coaching. Head of football methodology at Monaco said of the Soccer Coach's Toolkit, it is a very useful book for coaches to widen their session database and provide variety in their coaching. Head of soccer development at Christ College Secondary School in London, Daniel Nielsen, called the Soccer Coach's Toolkit a truly comprehensive library of drills and sessions for the whole spectrum of soccer techniques and tactics. In addition, the book has already been purchased and endorsed by former Wolverhampton Wanderers and Sunderland defender Jody Craddock, as well as ex-Leicester City striker Trevor Benjamin and Sutton United defender Joe Kissy. The Soccer Coach's Toolkit is the ticket to a lifetime of soccer coaching ideas, a must book to include in your soccer coaching library. Welcome to the GP Soccer Podcast, English and European Football Roundup, with your host, Rob Ellis.
Hi everyone, and greetings from London. This is Rob Ellis with the fourth edition of my European Soccer Roundup. In today's show, we're going to take a closer look at what is wrong with the English Premier League's two current crisis clubs, Tottenham Hotspur and Crystal Palace. I'm going to offer you some insights into the technical, tactical and human failings that have sent both of these London clubs off the rails. And with the end of the EPL season in sight, I'm going to illustrate how things might look for both clubs if they can fix their problems, or conversely, if they can't. In the final section of the show, we're going to check in on the home nations, England, Republic of Ireland, Northern Ireland, Scotland and Wales, who have all been in action in the Euro Championships qualifiers. I'll give you an update on how they've fared so far, as well as giving you a feel for the big issues in their respective camps. So let's get the ball rolling, and this means a look at the first of our two crisis clubs, Tottenham Hotspur. Spurs currently lie fourth in the English Premier League table. They've got little realistic chance of catching Manchester United in third place, who are 1 point better off, but critically have two games in hand, and no chance of catching Manchester City or Arsenal at the top. Tottenham are also out of all cup competitions, much to the disappointment of their fans. Spurs are trophyless since their 2008 League Cup win. The reality of another empty-handed season is a painful one, and the debate as to whether Spurs can be truly considered an elite club with such a paucity of silverware divides opinion far and wide. On a positive note, Spurs are still in a good position to secure a Champions League spot. They have a fight on their hands to keep their noses ahead of Newcastle and Liverpool, but if the superhuman Harry Kane can stay fit, Spurs may have just enough. Tottenham could and possibly should have won their first league title since 1961 in 2016, but ended up a disappointing third behind Arsenal and eventual champions Leicester. In 2019, Tottenham almost grabbed the ultimate prize of the Champions League, but after a thrilling run to the final, they fell at the final hurdle to Liverpool. The Nearly Men also ran tags as driven Spurs fans to distraction. In recent seasons, they've had bragging rights over their rivals Arsenal, with six consecutive finishes above them in the Premier League table, but ultimately the feelings of failure have been bubbling away for far too long. The camel's back was finally broken last weekend when Spurs blew a two-goal lead against bottom of the table Southampton. In a volcanic post-match interview, manager Antonio Conte lifted the lid on life as Tottenham boss. Conte labelled his players selfish and unable to cope with pressure. He repeatedly described himself as unhappy and expressed shame at the potential of fighting for 7th or 8th place. He didn't stop there. He laid plenty of blame at chairman Daniel Levy's door, suggesting that whoever the manager is at Spurs, they're unable to win a trophy. He suggested that the managers change, but the chairman doesn't, and the failure plays out the same season in, season out. Conte looked like a man asking for the sack and wanting to bloody as many noses as possible before he departs. His words have thrust the problems at Spurs into the limelight. The fans are torn between wanting him out as soon as possible, but also valuing his honesty as a catalyst for change. With rumours of players at Spurs not wanting to play for him anymore, and a seemingly inevitable exit at the end of the season, many fans want him out now and the immediate return of the much-loved Maurizio Pochettino. However, with Conte's cat out of the bag, which elite managers would currently want the job? So, was Conte right? Does he have the answers, or is he refusing to take responsibility for his own failings? On the pitch, Spurs have been rather dull to watch. Spurs fans were willing to accept this for a while if it guaranteed a trophy. However, like Jose Mourinho before him, neither has delivered a trophy. Conte has stuck rigidly to a 3-4-2-1 formation, home and away, regardless of the balance or the state of the game. In attack, Spurs have been stodgy, and without Harry Kane would barely be mid-table, but surely a manager of Conte's quality could have got more out of the whole team as an attacking unit. Players like Longley, Bissouma, Royale and Richarlison have failed to impress, and the quality of the first 11 looks rather unconvincing. Even top talents like Kulusevski and Heung-min Son seem to have gone backwards this season under Conte's leadership. The rest of the season is going to be highly unpredictable for Spurs. Rather ironically, it would seem they're more likely to get a fourth place finish if they do keep Conte, as it's unlikely they'll be able to appoint a new manager before the summer. If they don't appoint a manager, this would mean that Ryan Mason takes over as caretaker manager with 10 games of the season left. He could be in charge of a very demotivated squad, and this could be a very risky approach by the Spurs board. Tottenham desperately need a fourth place finish. If they don't qualify for the Champions League, there's a good chance that Kane and possibly Son could leave, which would leave the new manager with a mediocre squad, a ruthless chairman, and Europa League football. Spurs are in a perilous position. This is a key period in their recent history, with long-term implications that could liberate or liquidise Spurs. Our second crisis club are the Eagles, Crystal Palace. Since the turn of the year, when Palace had 19 points from 14 league games and a respectable record of 5 wins, 4 draws and 5 losses, Palace have amassed an awful 8 points from the last 14 games. Palace simply can't score. Their record of 5 goals in the last 12 EPL games is the stuff of managerial nightmares. Their last result was a demoralising 4-1 defeat against Arsenal, and prior to this they lost 1-0 to their rivals Brighton in what turned out to be Patrick Vieira's last game in charge. Palace chairman Steve Parish seemed genuinely upset to sack Vieira, as up until last Christmas he was seen to be doing a very good job. Vieira had Palace playing a more attractive and attack-minded style of football than their previous, and ironically now the current incumbent, Roy Hodgson. First time round, Hodgson did a very good job at Palace, and he's admired and loved in equal measure by the Selhurst Park faithful. Palace had become a dogged team with a sprinkling of magical talent under Hodgson. They guaranteed a tough game for anyone, particularly the top six, who Palace repeatedly achieved excellent results against. When Hodgson handed the reins at Selhurst Park over to Vieira in 2021, after finishes of 14th, 14th, 12th and 11th in the table, it felt like the ending of a marriage that, despite much love and respect, had no new roads to travel. So what has taken Palace back to Hodgson after what appeared to be an exciting new relationship with Patrick Vieira? In terms of personnel, Vieira's Palace is largely similar to where Hodgson left off. Seven or eight of Vieira's regulars were also regulars under Hodgson, and added to this the emergence of England centre-back Mark Gay and the staggering talent that is Michael Olise, it would seem that Hodgson can attack the rest of the EPL season with confidence. There is no lack of quality in Palace's first 11, and on paper, they look far too good to go down. Gehi and Anderson are a tough, talented and uncompromising centre-back partnership, and the full-back combination of Klein and Mitchell would be the envy of many EPL managers. Vieira often opted for a 4-2-3-1 formation during his reign and had three lavishly gifted forwards to play off the number 9 in Wilfried Zaha, Eberechi Eze and Michael Olise. On their day, these three could tear apart any Premier League defence. So through process of elimination, it seems that the weak spots for Palace are the centre of the park and the number 9 position. In centre midfield, Vieira usually went for Cheick Doucouré, who's a bullish type of player, with one of Cheick Coyote, Jeff Schlupp, Will Hughes, or less frequently the veteran Luka Milivojevic, until the arrival of Sambi Lokonga from Arsenal, who's become a recent regular in the team. Each and every one of these options is a good Premier League player, but there's not quite enough in this area to dictate games. This means that Palace don't get enough possession to dominate, and there's a sense of much of a muchness in the engine room. Speak to any Palace fan and they will tell you, however, that the main problem is they simply can't score goals, and they may well have a point. Worryingly, Palace have only scored 23 goals in 28 EPL games. If this drought continues, Palace have every chance of being relegated. The problem is that they don't have a single number 9 option that looks capable of scoring, and with the transfer window closed, Palace now have to work with what they've got. The stats are damning. Zaha is Palace's top scorer with 6 goals this season. However, he's a winger. After Zaha, Odson Edouard, who's a number 9, has notched a paltry 5 goals. His number 9 associates Jordan Ayew and Jean-Philippe Mateta have both scored 1 goal each. These statistics are ghastly. Rather worryingly for Palace fans, Hodgson is seen as a pragmatic coach. Vieira was seen as the man to add some French flair to Hodgson's English solidity. So it has surprised many that chairman Steve Parish has gone back to the future and called upon the 75-year-old Hodgson to get the Eagles firing at the key point of the season. If Hodgson can stop Palace snowballing into the Championship, he must get one of his strikers scoring. Even a moderate return from one of his strikers would likely see Palace to safety. Relegation would be a disaster for Palace. Hodgson would probably leave for good, and they would also likely lose the talents of Zaha, Gehi, Eze and Olise. With 10 games to go, Palace fans face a nervous end to the Premier League season. So as it's the international break, let's take a look at how the home nations are getting on. England have started their European Championships qualifying campaign impressively, with wins over Italy 2-1 and Ukraine 2-0. Harry Kane scored in both games and in the process passed Wayne Rooney as England's all-time leading goal scorer with 55 goals. The Spurs hitman looks likely to take the record closer to 100 goals if he can maintain his exploits for years to come. The Republic of Ireland manager Stephen Kenny has steadfastly backed youth since he took the job in 2020. He's endured some tough results and criticism for following this policy, but his national team had become stale and worryingly uncompetitive against the international elite. They warmed up on Monday night with a 3-2 win over Latvia, but they face a daunting opener against France. In the north, Michael O'Neill has returned to the Windsor Park hot seat after 3 years in charge of Stoke City. As I speak, Northern Ireland trail Finland 1-0 after winning their first qualification match 2-0 against San Marino. O'Neill will be hoping to restore former glories to Northern Ireland. In his first spell, he led them to the second round in their first ever European Championships. Over in Wales, they're looking to life after Gareth Bale, with Rob Page still in the dugout and former gunner Aaron Ramsey as Bale's replacement as skipper. The early signs are promising as Wales salvaged an injury time draw against Croatia in their first qualification match. Finally, Scotland secured a 3-0 win in their opening match with goals from John McGinn and a brace for Scott McTominay. Manager Steve Clarke continues to do an excellent job for the Scots, and with a talented squad at his disposal, many will tip them to emerge as qualifiers from their group. Well, guys, time flies, and that's my time up for another week. I hope you enjoyed today's show and are looking forward to more of the same next time round. For now, take care and best wishes from London.
Well, many thanks to Rob Ellis for another outstanding EPL and European report. It's such a pleasure to have him on the GP Soccer Podcast week in and week out. Many thanks, Rob. We look forward to next week's report. And again, many thanks to Jared Scarpacci for being our interview guest today, boys soccer coach at Masconomic High School in Topsfield, Massachusetts. Boy, this was a bit of a marathon today. Now, wasn't it, folks? But I think it was worth every mile of that marathon. So that's our show for today. If you like what you heard, please tell everyone. You can follow the GP Soccer Podcast on Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, Twitter, Linktree, and on my website at gpsoccerpodcast.com. And don't forget to tune into Direct Kick every Tuesday night from 6 to 7 p.m. on WMEX AM 1510 and streaming on WMEXBoston.com. This is your host, Giovanni Pacini, and I will catch you later.